Well, those of you who are at school are perhaps getting to the point now with just 1 week of the term remaining where things are starting to wind down a bit. Less maths and grammar going on, more fun outdoorsy activities. Well, in this hour, last session for the time being on Proverbs, we're doing the opposite. We're pulling out all the stops. We're considering a passage that has no fewer than 19 verses in it. And indeed a passage which midway through switches from one theme to another quite unconnected one. So tonight you mustn't put your brains into end of term mode. They need to be firing on all cylinders in order to get to grips with this large and disparate passage. And so let's start getting to grips with it then by looking first of all at verses 12 to 17. And I'm entitling this material, Dangers in a World of Abundant Blessings. Dangers in a World of Abundant Blessings. This is a world of abundant blessings, isn't it? For all that the world is cursed, for all that it's marred now by many bad and sad things, we can still sing, as we did in our opening hymn this evening, about the earth with its store of wonders untold. We can still sing your bountiful care. What tongue can recite? It breathes in the air. It shines in the light. It streams from the hills. It descends to the plain and sweetly distills in the dew and the rain. This world, far, far from being the hell that we deserve it to be, it's full of sights and sounds and tastes and activities that delight and enrich us. It's a world of abundant blessings. And there are texts in the Bible that tell us very explicitly how, as God's people, we should approach all these good things in the world. Let me just mention two that are in close proximity to each other. So 1 Timothy 4, verse 4. For everything God created is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving. And then 1 Timothy 6, 17, God richly provides us with everything to enjoy. So on the basis of those two texts, then, we can identify three distinct responses that are appropriate living in this world of abundant blessings. Response number one, acceptance. We're not to reject those good things in the world around us. Has been far too unspiritual for us. Nothing is to be rejected, Paul says. We are to accept them as from God and good, therefore. Response number two, gratitude. With thanksgiving, accept them, Paul says. And then response number three, enjoyment. We are to unashamedly derive pleasure from these good things that God has filled this world with. So those are three healthy responses to all the good things in this world. But as my first heading tonight indicates, there's the potential for unhealthy responses too. And that's what verses 12 to 17 of our passage here are interested in, dangers associated with this world's blessings. So, first of all, the danger of neglecting them. The danger of neglecting them. That's verses 12 and 13. So verse 13 envisages a guy and he's not enjoying the bounty of this creation. He hasn't got nice, tasty bread on his table. But there's a reason for that. And the reason for that is that he is lazy. He loves his sleep. He would rather be in bed than sowing and harvesting and tending the crops. As on other occasions when Proverbs treats the lazy person as a touch of humor, I think, in these two verses, you know how we might say to someone who's failing to think things through properly, God has given you a brain, use it. And notice here then that the eye is mentioned in both those verses, both verses, verse 12 and verse 13. And Solomon then is saying in verse 12, God has given you a seeing eye. And then in verse 13, he's basically saying, so jolly well, use it. Don't keep it shut the whole time while you sleep too much. And then, if you use your eyes rather than shutting them in sleep the whole time, you might be able to enjoy some of God's good gifts a bit more. Now, I'm not going to labour this point of laziness that we've encountered several times in the last few weeks anyway, but I think it is worth highlighting in our context the danger of neglecting the abundant blessings of this creation, not perhaps by being asleep the whole time as we have here, but for other reasons, like, for instance, being on screens the whole time. That's a modern problem, isn't it? I mean, screens can be a great instrument for good, I've no doubt, but you don't have to walk around Newcastle or anywhere else in our Western world for very long to realise that this phenomenon is taking over. Our horizons have been horribly shrunk. There's a world of good things out there, a world of real life experiences to enjoy, and we're kind of neglecting it all as we retreat into this virtual world that I hold in my hand and I keep on my bedside table and I panic if I go out of the house without it one morning. The danger of neglecting these blessings. And then a second danger, the danger of overrating them. The danger of overrating these abundant blessings. That's verses 14 and 15. I talked last Sunday morning, you may remember, about that story that Jesus told of the man who found the treasure, but it was in a field that didn't belong to him, so he buried the treasure again and then went and bought the field. And I said that Jesus isn't particularly interested in the ethical dimension of that story, whether the guy was really acting appropriately or not in burying the treasure again and going and buying the field without telling the field's owner what was going on. If you want to explore the ethical dimensions, you have to look elsewhere in the Bible from Matthew 13. And in fact, this isn't a bad place to look here in these verses, verses 14 and 15 of our passage here, because here you have a guy who's buying something. We can probably infer from verse 15 that it's some kind of precious stone that he's buying. And a bit like that woman, Jo Heaven, that I talked about last Sunday morning, who bought that piece of artwork in a charity shop in Swindon with an inkling that it was worth something. This guy, too, seemingly knows more about this stone that he's buying than the seller knows. And he knows then that it's valuable. That's why he goes away and boasts, verse 14, about his purchase. But, you see, he convinces the seller that it's not valuable. Oh, bad, bad, he says. That's just a worthless piece of old stone. I don't need to pay you much money for that. Now, that precious stone, then, it's a good and beautiful thing. Again, it's part of God's lavish creation. God hasn't created a drab, boring world, but a world where there's jewels and precious stones. It's fine for this man to rate that precious stone and to be attracted to it when he sees it in this shop. But when he's willing to lie to the seller and thus sacrifice his integrity for that precious stone, at that point he's overrating it, isn't he? And that's the point that Solomon makes in verse 15. He says there that lips of knowledge, that is good, righteous speech that's honest and trustworthy, lips of knowledge are actually more valuable than gold and abundance of costly stones. And this is such an important principle then, isn't it? Again, let me reiterate, it's fine to rate highly the good things that there are in this world. It's fine to rate a nice car or a holiday or a set of clothes. It's fine to work hard and save up for such things. But if ever we reach the point where we are prepared to lie or to steal or to cheat or to take advantage of someone in order to get our hands on such things, we're overrating those things, vastly overrating those things. Because at the end of the day, your integrity, your moral purity, is way more valuable than any material possession you have or any material possession you don't have. So prize it, Solomon is saying. Prize your integrity. Prize your moral purity. Jealously retain that. the danger of neglecting the abundant blessings, the danger of overrating them, and then a third danger, the danger of squandering them. This is verse 16. So this verse envisages a man, and for some reason he enters into this arrangement where the stranger, presumably the stranger, is launching out on some business venture. And the man says to this stranger, look, I'll put up security for you. That is, I'll pay off any debts that this business venture you're launching might incur. And Solomon says then that the very moment the man agrees to do that, you might as well take the shirt off his back, because that's what he's going to end up losing. He's going to end up losing everything. It's a stupid, reckless, rash arrangement he's entered into. And it's a reminder to us then that when God has blessed us with the good things of his creation, we are to be wise and good stewards of those resources, which certainly doesn't mean being stingy. We are to share and to use our resources to help others, but throwing money rashly at flawed schemes and projects is not a God-honoring way to behave. The danger of neglecting the blessings, of overrating them, of squandering them, and then one more danger, the danger of ruining them. And this is verse 17. And the point here then is that when we engage with the abundant blessings of this world in a sinful way, we don't just displease God by doing that. Of course, we do displease God. But we actually ruin the blessings themselves. The sinful engagement with those blessings removes the enjoyment from them, actually. It extracts the pleasure out of them. So bread is the example that's given in here in verse 17. Bread, of course, a lovely blessing from God. But here it's gained by deceit. It's stolen, effectively. And notice then that this bread gained by deceit, it still briefly yields the expected enjoyment. It's sweet to the man in the first line there. But then afterwards, it becomes like the person has eaten a handful of gravel. Perhaps it's because his conscience kicks in. And his conscience plagues him and prods him and afflicts him and troubles him. And this bread then, which, yes, at the very moment of ingestion tasted so sweet, it leaves a bad taste in his mouth. And it applies then this principle beyond bread, doesn't it? Sex is an obvious area where it applies. In fact, I think that bread here may well be intended as a metaphor for that. It's very similar language we have in this verse to what we have in chapter 9, verse 17. And in chapter 9, verse 17, you have this seductive woman speaking. She's called Folly. And she's trying to seduce the men that pass by her house. And she says various things to try and do that. And in verse 17 then of chapter 9, she says, stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. And we know then that water in those early chapters of Proverbs is definitely a metaphor for sexual satisfaction. It's been used in that way in chapter 5. And so she's saying stolen water is sweet. That is sexual satisfaction derived in an illicit way. It's sweet, she's saying. So come into my house. And the bread then seems to be an accompanying metaphor for the same thing. And bread then may function in that same way here in our passage and in verse 17. In other words then, when sex is misused, yes, it may still yield brief excitement, but it turns into gravel, Solomon is saying. Does that not sum up where our society is at? Where sex has been misused and has turned to gravel. Jeff Thomas writes, in the movies, unmarried passion is marvellous and exciting. In the real world, unmarried passion leads a trail of burned out lovers, broken hearts, nasty diseases, unwanted pregnancies, and a damaged capacity ever to enjoy the permanent passion of marriage. Don't seek, he says, passion apart from permanence. And so, here in these verses then, verses 12 to 17, Solomon is talking about the many good things that God has blessed this creation with. And we know from elsewhere then what our positive responsibility, our positive approach should be. We should accept these things as from God. We should be thankful for them. We should enjoy them. Solomon is saying, and be careful about these dangers. Neglecting them, overrating them, squandering them, ruining them through sinful misuse. And so some helpful principles there that we can apply living in this world of abundant blessings. So dangers in a world of abundant blessings. But then the second theme that we encounter in this passage, I'm going to entitle Strategies in a World of Reckless Speech. Strategies in a World of Reckless Speech. And this is verses 18 to 30. So speech is another of those topics that has come up again and again. You may remember that in chapter 18, verses 12 to 24, the focus was on harsh, condemning, aggressive speech. That's what was in view there. Here, however, in this passage, in verses 18 to 30, it's reckless speech that's in view. That is, impulsive speech. Speech that's poorly thought through or not thought through at all. Speech that's just uncontrolled, just thrown out without due consideration. That's what's in view in these verses. And in terms of strategies then, in a world where there's much of this goes on, much reckless speech, in terms of strategies, the passage points in three directions. First of all, outwards. Outwards, i.e., to dealing with others who have this tendency. Others who have the tendency to speak recklessly. And this is verses 18 and 19. So in verse 18, we have an important principle set down that we need people around us whom we can confide in. Plans are established by counsel. By wise guidance, wage war. And I don't think here Solomon is actually giving us advice how we should go and wage a war, but rather it's just that principle that in every realm, not least in the military realm, but in every realm, counsel, guidance is necessary. We're not one-man islands, one-woman islands, but we need others whom we can confide in and whom we can be helped by. You have a striking example of this in Acts chapter 16. You know how there Paul is on one of his missionary journeys, and you remember how in Acts chapter 16 he wants to go to Asia, but he's forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia. That's verse 6 of Acts 16. And so they then tried to go to Bithynia, verse 7, but the Spirit of Jesus did not allow that. So passing by Mysia, they went down to Troas, and a vision appeared to Paul in the night. A man of Macedonia was standing there urging him and saying, come over to Macedonia and help us. And so Paul has this vision, and you think, well, this is wonderful. Paul getting this direct revelation from God. He's going to drop everything and go now to Macedonia. But look at verse 10. And when Paul had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go on into Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. And two things there. Number one, the word concluding, it's quite a strong word to do with kind of consulting with one another. And number two, it is clearly Luke here speaking as collective, we concluded. It wasn't just Paul, because he's seen a vision, he said, right, I'm off. No, we sat down and we consulted and we talked about it. So even though Paul had this vision, he still didn't just drop everything and act impulsively, but he rather sought the advice and the counsel of others. So that's what verse 18 of our passage is reminding us, that we do need to have others around us in whom we can confide. But verse 19 is then saying, remember, there are people that you can't confide in. There are people whose speech is reckless. People who are big mouths, who are babblers in the language that Solomon uses. And we need to be discerning then. Yes, as a general principle, we need others whom we can confide in, but we can't confide in just anyone. Because some will not be reliable. They can't be entrusted with the things that we're talking about. They'll just go and spread them around recklessly. I suppose it's another application of Jesus' principle, isn't it, about throwing pearls before pigs. And we need to be careful then whom we confide in, and wise and discerning. And so that's what I mean then when I say the passage points out was, first of all, there are others who might have this tendency of reckless speech, so just be careful that you're guarded, that you don't make yourself a hostage to fortune by confiding in a way that's inappropriate with those who can't be entrusted with that information. So the passage points outwards, but then more considerably it points inwards. That is, to dealing with our own tendencies to reckless speech. And these verses then, they mention a few factors that can easily push us into reckless speech, and where therefore we need to be on our guard. So one is chastisement. Look at verse 20. If one curses his father or his mother, his lamp will be put out in utter darkness. And it seems a bit of a random kind of proverb there, this reference to someone cursing their father or mother. But I think we're to probably link verse 20 with the last verse of the passage, verse 30. Blows that wound cleanse away evil. Strokes make clean the innermost parts. That's talking about chastisement. And that's probably the context then here. And it's envisaging a situation where a child is being chastised, and instead of accepting that chastisement and using that chastisement and building on that chastisement, instead they just speak out recklessly and curse the parents who are doing this. And so it's another reminder to those of you who are younger in the congregation tonight to be willing to accept the correction of your parents. But there's a broader application, I'm sure, to all of us. We all need to be rebuked sometimes, don't we? Perhaps especially by those who are older. And verse 29 mentions the splendor of old men, their gray hair, and reverence that we should have for those who are older and wiser. And we all sometimes need to be rebuked and must make sure that in a situation where someone is just taking us aside and giving us a word of correction, we don't lash out recklessly and unwisely, but rather we take it on board and accept it in a godly manner. Another factor that can push us into reckless speech is greed. So look at verse 21, an inheritance gained hastily in the beginning will not be blessed in the end. Now, no actual speech is explicitly mentioned there, but it's envisaging a situation like the one we have in Luke 15, isn't it? Jesus' famous parable, where you have the son who goes to his father and says, I want it now. I want the inheritance now. That's the kind of reckless speech that's in view in verse 21. An inheritance gained hastily. And Solomon says, it will turn out bad. It turned out bad for that boy, didn't it, in Jesus' parable. And again, we can apply the principle of verse 21 more broadly, I think. It's not just kind of necessarily a situation where you're asking for your inheritance early, but that reckless speech that is motivated by greed. It might be that you're offered a promotion or offered a different job and it pays a lot more money and the pound signs start flashing, and so just immediately you grasp for that. Yes, I'm having that. I'm taking that. Without any thought, what will this move to a different place do to my family? What will it do to me in my relationship with Christ? Are there believers there? Is there a church in that place? No, just rashly, yes, I'm taking this, without thinking through the things that need to be thought through. So chastisement, greed, another factor that can push us into reckless speech, mistreatment. Verse 22, do not say, I will repay evil. So here then, it's envisaging a situation where you've been mistreated, someone has dealt with you badly, and Solomon is saying, don't lash out in that situation. I'm going to get my own back here. I'm going to get even. I'm going to settle this score. And it's very similar to Paul's thinking in Romans 12, isn't it? We were talking about this at Time Out on Tuesday. Paul's fascinating language there in Romans 12, where you remember he says, do not take revenge. This is verse 19. Never avenge yourselves. And he could just stop there, couldn't he? Or he could say, never avenge yourselves, because revenge is just wrong. But no, he carries on, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. In other words, it's not that justice doesn't matter. It's that justice isn't your business. That's not your problem. When someone has mistreated you, justice does matter. And there is a God, therefore, who one day will ensure that justice is done, but he will do that. And you leave room for him, and you don't take it into your own hands. Your job is simply to restrain yourself from vengeance. Perhaps verse 23 here is suggesting that the precise context in view where you've been mistreated is in a commercial setting and someone has cheated you. And use those unequal weights and false scales that we've come across so often in Proverbs. And they've cheated you. And so you are just filled with rage and you want to get that person back. And it's interesting then that in verse 23, Solomon says, look, it's an abomination to the Lord as well. It's not that it's fine for someone to go around cheating other people. The Lord hates what that person has done. But still, don't take it upon yourself to exact revenge. The Lord, who abominates what that person has done, he will sort that out. Leave it to him. In your immediate emotion that floods in at that point, don't speak recklessly and seek revenge. So chastisement, greed, mistreatment. And then one more factor that can push us into reckless speech, enthusiasm. Verse 25, an interesting verse. It is a snare to say rashly, it is holy, and to reflect only after making vows. So this is the idea then of kind of consecrating something to the Lord in a kind of moment of enthusiasm, religious enthusiasm, fervor for the Lord. Kind of, this thing I'm devoting to you, Lord, it's holy, it's yours. That's as we have an example of this being done well with Hannah, don't we, in the Bible, and the way that she said of her son, Samuel, it is holy, he is holy, he's yours. If you give me a son, he's yours, Lord. And she carried that through, and the son was Yahweh's. But this verse is saying, don't do that rashly, in a way that you're going to then regret and find yourself going back upon. Don't, in a moment of fervor and enthusiasm, say, Lord, my next wage packet, it's all yours. And then find yourself in a couple of weeks' time saying, sorry, Lord, I didn't really mean that. Because that's blasphemously treating the Lord as someone you can just throw out commitments to and then withdraw them from. And so these different factors then that can push us into reckless speech, we need to guard our hearts. We don't just need to know how to deal with the reckless speech of others, but reckless speech in ourselves. So the passage points outwards, inwards, and then one more direction, it points upwards. Because I want to close just drawing your attention to verse 28, where we read, steadfast love and faithfulness preserve the king, and by steadfast love his throne is upheld. And we've seen these kind of king proverbs scattered about, haven't we, over these last few weeks. And I said then that yes, to some degree perhaps they apply to a normal king in Israel, but so often these king proverbs, they don't actually seem to apply to any king that we know of in Israel, not even the best ones that we know of. And that's true here, isn't it? Steadfast love and faithfulness preserve the king. By steadfast love his throne is upheld. Which king actually lived that out? I mean, all the Israelite kings come under what's said in verse 6 of this chapter, don't they? Many a man proclaims his own steadfast love, but a faithful man who can find? That applies to the kings of Israel as much as to anyone else. They failed in this area, just like we all do. They would say the right things. They would throw out great promises and great commitments, but they weren't able to actually live by them. And so I think these king proverbs so often are pointing us ultimately upwards to a greater king than any that sat on Israel's throne. They're pointing us to the king, to Jesus. And of him alone then it can be said that steadfast love upholds his throne, that he is full of steadfast love and faithfulness. And that's where I want us to finish tonight, then, in a world of reckless speech, where we have experienced others just blurting out things that had no substance, no meaning, where we've done this so often ourselves. What a wonderful thing that we have a king who never does that. A king who makes staggering promises. We sang a few minutes ago that hymn, "O Jesus, I have promised." Of course, the most important verse in that hymn is verse 4, "O Jesus, thou hast promised to all who follow thee that where thou art in glory, there shall thy servant be." We began tonight with a staggering promise of Jesus, didn't we? Those who believe in me, on the last day I will raise him up. And I'm saying then that Jesus makes none of those promises rashly and recklessly. They're not promises that evaporate into the ether, that dissolve, that unravel. They are promises that genuinely are full of steadfast love and faithfulness. You can rely on Jesus' promises. You can rely tonight with all that you are on Jesus' promise that if you come to him, he will save you from your sin. He will wash you clean. He will raise you up on the last day. That's not an elusive thing he says. It's not a thing that he will wriggle out of at any point. You can rely on everything he said. Are you relying on the promises of Jesus tonight? In a world of silly, flimsy, specious, empty speech, are you relying on the strong words of Jesus, these promises that will hold for time and eternity? What a wonderful thing. Amen.